Okay, good morning, everybody. We've got Bio 241, and it's November 15th. We're going to finish up Chapter 13. We just got to go over electrical activity of the heart, then move on to 14, and then we can figure out when the next test is going to be. Depends on how fast I go. But I want to go fast, but you should still ask questions. All right? I heard a question, but I didn't really quite hear it. Oh, I can't tell you exactly when the test is going to be yet. Okay? All right, so next week we just have one session, just on Tuesday. All right, so this week we've got two, next week we've got one, and for sure I can finish up chapter 14 next week. I just don't know if I can finish it up this week. All right, so let's get started and look at it. Who should be up for a test? Should it be the Tuesday labs or the Thursday labs? Where are we? Thursday labs, we've had tests on Tuesday so far only, I think. Okay. All right, so. Oh, we had one and one. So it doesn't matter who gets a test.
We had two Tuesdays and one Thursday.
Two Tuesdays and one Thursday. Okay, so Thursday is looking like a better time. All right, let's talk about electrical activity of the heart. Yeah, so I probably won't give an extra credit assignment next week. So I think the Thursday lab skips that lab. I'll have to look at the syllabus. All right, so the Thursday lab skips, and then you just keep in tune with the Tuesday labs that way. Okay, and the syllabus, it should say. If you skip that one or if it wraps around, but I don't think it wraps around anymore. I think it's just a skip. Yeah, because nobody will be here to give you a quiz. Okay. So no extra credit for anybody next week. Okay. Because there's only one lab. That would be really bad if I were only giving the Tuesday people a quiz. Unless it's a take-home extra credit. I don't know how much that would help everybody. Okay. There's something about sitting in a seat just by yourself and taking a quiz that really helps your mind out a lot more. All right, so let's carry on. Electrical activity of the heart. Remember, myocardium is made up of special muscle tissue. Okay, it's specialized to contract, just like other kinds of muscle tissue. But what can you tell me about heart muscle? Tell me some things about heart muscle. It's involuntary, right? Just like smooth muscle. It has layers. It's got the three layers: epicardium, myocardium, and endocardium, which is the contractile layer. It's the myocardium. The myocardium is right. And do you have sarcomeres? Yeah, you do. Which is a distinction compared to smooth muscle. Smooth muscle doesn't have sarcomeres. It still has actin and myosin. Smooth muscle still has actin and myosin, but are not arranged in sarcomeres. But the heart is. Okay, and it's got intercalated discs, which actually just kind of leads right into the first statement that we're talking about right here. And that is, actually before I get to that first statement, I did want to say that the heart is autorhythmic. Okay, so you guys that are talking back there, I would really like to hear your lecture. Who wants to hear their lecture? Come on down. All right, if you want to hear my lecture, all right, stay in the room. If you don't want to hear it, then just go out in the hallway or something, okay? And I can't, and you guys know you have me because I can't see your names because I'm recording for the internet, but please, all right, keep it down so that everybody can hear. All right, so the heart, when you remove the heart from an animal, we used to do this in anatomy lab, it beats on its own, right? So it does not need innervation. And that's the same thing, just like Raiders of the Lost Ark. We could rip our hearts out of our chests, and of course, we would perish, but our heart would sit there and contract for at least a short period of time, right? And that's because the heart is autorhythmic. There are certain cells called nodal cells inside the heart that spontaneously depolarize. And what do you know about depolarization? What causes depolarization? Typically, it's an excitatory signal like sodium entering the cell. right? And that's an excitation. That's an excitatory signal. So some cells just do that automatically. They leak sodium ions. Right, so the heart is autoarrhythmic, and when one of these cells depolarizes, the whole heart contracts, because these are not long fibers like we see in skeletal muscle. They're short fibers, and they're branched, and these short fibers will pull away from each other, and you'll have a hole in your heart, but that doesn't really happen, because what can you tell me about the connections between myocardial cells? What are they called? They're called... And you've seen this in anatomy. They're little dark lines that separate the individual myocardial cells. They're called intercalated discs, right? So there's special adherence junctions between myocardial cells so that they don't pull apart from each other. And even more importantly, if we look at this slide over here, within the intercalated discs, they have gap junctions. And what can you tell me about a gap junction? It's one of two kinds of special things that you had to learn about. And that is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. What is that thing called? That's a synapse, right? And you know two different kinds of synapses. What are the two kinds? Chemical and electrical. And which kind is a gap junction? That's an electrical synapse, right? So that when one cell gets excited electrically via depolarization, that depolarization can travel to its neighboring cells, which then spreads that depolarization to its neighboring cells and goes on and on and on and on. So the heart contracts as a unit because of these gap junctions right here, which is something that... Oh, dear, how do I get this over here? Ah, this button? No, that button's not hooked up. I don't want my cursor to go away, but I don't know how to do it with this mouse. If I push that, nope, push that, that, no. Okay, never mind. I'll just have to keep my cursor active right here. Oh, I've got to go backwards. There we go. All right, so the heart contracts as a unit, which is what you need in order for it to act as a pump. You can't have one part of a ventricle contracting and another part relaxing, because the part that's contracting is just going to push blood in the part that's relaxing. But where should the heart pump blood? Not within a ventricle, but where? Into an artery that leaves the heart, and a good example of that would be the aorta. So the whole ventricle has to contract to make sure that blood gets ejected up into an artery. Okay, and so you should know, how many chambers does the heart have? And how many valves does it have? All right, that's just some basic anatomy of the heart. All right, and the chambers are made out of the muscle, which is the myocardium layer. All right, and it's a functional syncytium, which means that all of these cells have electrical synapses between them. And what's the name of that special electrical synapse? What's the name of an electrical synapse between myocardial cells? Gap junction. Yeah, gap junction, right? So you looked at the composition of gap junctions before. All right, so action potentials originating in any cell are transmitted to all others, right? But not just from the base down to the apex, but also through the whole wall thickness, because these cells are branched. So you don't have just one cell in one layer of the heart, but it actually goes through different layers of the heart, exciting all the different layers of the heart. So all of the muscles contract. All right, except for one distinction, and that is there are no connections, electrical connections, between the atria and the ventricles, because they're connected by the fibrous skeleton or the fibrous myocardium of the heart, and that's connective tissue. It doesn't conduct action potentials. All right, so the atria contract followed by the ventricle. So let's see why that is. All right, so the fibrous myocardium separates electrically the atria from the ventricles. And the atria contract first, so the autorhythmic cells that depolarize at the fastest frequency are near the junction of the superior vena cava and the right atrium. We call that the sinoatrial node. And when these depolarize, that depolarization flows over all of the cells of the atria, right, because it's a functional syncytium. They're all connected by gap junctions. And that's an excitatory signal, which then causes the muscles to contract. Right, that wave of depolarization actually ends up down in this part of the right atrium, and this is the atrioventricular node, and this is the only pathway for action potentials to enter the ventricular myocardium. However, the AV node delays the signal about 100 milliseconds, maybe 200 milliseconds, and then it passes the action potentials down to the atrioventricular bundle in the interventricular septum, and there's a branch right about this level within the septum, and these are what we call the bundle branches, and action potentials travel very rapidly all the way down to, what part of the heart is down here? Oh, it's on the diagram. That's not such a good quiz. That's the apex of the heart right here, and then there are some branches that we call Purkinje fibers that then spread action potentials to the contractile cells of the myocardium. So what you see in yellow right here are myocardial cells, but these are specialized, right, to conduct action potentials. They're not specialized to contract. So these are non-contractile cells, but nonetheless, they're still muscle fibers. All right, so how is it? What component within a membrane allows these cells to transmit action potentials? Right? Just like what you see on skeletal muscle and axons within neurons, what kind of protein within the cell membrane allows these muscle cells to conduct action potentials? Well, can you tell me about an action potential? Maybe I can conjure up some memories of previous good times that you've had in here. Okay? What can you tell me about an action potential? Does it die away?
No.
It is conducted without decrement from one end of the cell to another, as long as that cell has what?
Generator potential.
Yeah, generator potentials, that would be an excitation signal, but in terms of proteins within the cell membrane, what kind of proteins have to be in the cell membrane in order for that to happen? How about a voltage-gated channel? Remember, you had to draw an action potential out, and if the membrane potential reaches threshold, what kind of channels open up? Sodium channels, which is an excitatory signal, right? And those are what kind of channels?
Voltage-gated
channels. That's right. So there are voltage-gated channels on all of these cells right here that transmit action potentials, and in this region, it's transmitted very rapidly down to the apex. So the apex receives that excitatory signal before the basilar regions of the heart. So it's the apex that contracts first as a result. Question?
Yeah, just a quick one. Why does the AV node delay? I mean, it's only for
100 milliseconds or so?
Yeah, but why does it only delay it for that?
Okay, so okay, because the job of the atria, even though it's not a very important job, the job of the atria is to contract and pump a little bit of blood into the ventricles. The job of the ventricles is to pump blood into arteries, but the ventricles can only pump blood into arteries is only when there's blood inside the ventricles. Right? So if the ventricles contract and there's no blood in there, they're going to contract just fine, but they won't be pumping blood into the arteries. So it's the job of the atria to top off, all right, the volume of these ventricles right here so that they, when they do contract, they pump out the maximum amount of blood that can be pumped out. Okay, so that's the job. Not real important. I don't have a figure in my mind, but less than 10% of the volume of a ventricle comes from when the atria contract. It's a very small amount of blood. More important in other kinds of animals, not so much in humans. So they can misbehave. Not too big of a clinical problem, but if they don't contract, that's a huge clinical problem because then blood will stay in an atrium. It won't be pushed into a ventricle, and we studied the phenomena in this particular chapter. All right, what happens to blood when it stays stationary, when it's not moving? I didn't cover this specifically. Maybe I did. It forms clots, right? It undergoes coagulation. And so you don't want a heart that is producing blood clots because those blood clots will go into an artery and then will occlude a lung. We call that pulmonary embolism. Could go to the brain, cause a stroke. Could go to the heart, cause a heart attack. All right, so if the atria are misbehaving, it's a significant clinical problem because you could affect the brain and heart and lungs. Right. So then you need to be on anticoagulation therapy. Like, what are some agents that can be used for anticoagulation therapy? Like, which one is really common, mostly used? It's Coumadin or Coumarin, right, in hospitals. Heparin can be used as well. So there are a couple of different agents when that happens. But it's better to have these atria functioning so that you don't have to take those pharmaceuticals. Okay, so these yellow lines right here are just modified myocytes that are loaded with voltage-gated channels which propagate action potentials in some places very rapidly, in other places very slowly. And that delay right here is just to ensure that the atria contract followed by the ventricles. Okay. Furthermore, when the ventricles contract, we said that the apical regions contract first, right? So blood will be pushed up toward the base of the heart, which is what you want, because what's at the base of the heart? The aorta, the great arteries, like the aorta, pulmonary trunk, right? So when the apical regions contract first, that forces blood up into the arteries. If the basal regions were to contract first, which way would blood be forced? Down to the apex, and it would have no place to go. All right, so that would be very inefficient, cause a lot of turbulence. Okay, and then I suppose if you use your science fiction mind, you could say, oh, it's even going to blow the heart out right here. Put a big hole and be blood all over the place. Okay, that wouldn't happen necessarily, but very ineffective. All right, so the heart has two kinds of cells. It's got nodal cells and it's got contractile cells. And here is an action potential from a nodal cell, part of the conduction system. Those are the yellow cells that we saw in the previous slide. And on this particular slide, notice it's missing an arrow pointing like right here that you see on a normal. What did you write on a normal action potential that you had to draw in lab? Right here. Okay. Well, baseline would be resting membrane potential. And then I see this deviation towards zero, right? So I see a little slope, and there would be an arrow pointing right here, and that was called the stimulus. Okay, notice there is no stimulus for a nodal cell. It just, once it reaches resting membrane potential, it automatically starts to depolarize all by itself. There is no stimulus. That's because these cells are autorhythmic, and they have special little sodium leak channels inserted into the membranes of just the nodal cells, not the contractile cells. We call these HCN channels. All right, an HCN channel is a sodium channel, and when it is leaking, sodium enters the cell, what happens to membrane potential when sodium leaks into the cell? It depolarizes, right? And then when it reaches threshold, guess what happens? Action potential starts, but in this particular case, okay, depolarization, this rapid depolarization of nodal tissues is produced by voltage-gated calcium channels. And where is calcium at a high concentration? Outside the cell, when this calcium channel opens, calcium rushes into the cell. And what kind of ion is calcium? Yeah, it's a bivalent cation, so the resting membrane potential depolarizes even faster. Right, and produces this action potential right here. And then repolarization is due to the typical mechanism that you're aware of, and that is potassium channels finally open up, which then causes repolarization. And when it gets to resting membrane potential, then these HCN channels open up again, but these aren't really, you don't have a lot of them. They're not really leaky like these calcium channels right here, so this depolarization is relatively slow until it reaches threshold, and then you have another peak. So you don't have a stimulus. This is just autorhythmicity that's controlled by these HCN channels. And when this cell depolarizes, what happens to neighboring cells? They depolarize as well. Because why? You could say because there are electrical synapses between the cells. And I could furthermore ask, what are those things called? And you would say gap junctions, right? Okay. All right, so this is an action potential from conductive cells or nodal cells within the myocardium. All right, other tissues in the heart are spontaneously active, right? But they spontaneously depolarize at a slower rate. Wow, I would like to go back. Oh, good. And for instance, let's look at the slope of this depolarization right here. If the slope is very shallow, right? If the slope goes like this, all right, will it take a longer or shorter period of time to reach threshold? A longer period of time. All right, so other tissues within the heart, other different areas within the heart, will spontaneously depolarize, but the slope of this depolarization will be much more shallow, right? And so it'll take much longer for them to become a pacemaker. And by that time, they've received these excitatory signals from the primary pacemaker within the heart. But if something happens to this tissue here, then other cells can take over the job of being pacemaker, but then it's going to be at a slower rate as a result of that. Okay, so other tissues are stimulated. They produce action potentials from because they're stimulated by the SA node. If action potentials from the SA node are prevented from reaching these, then they'll generate pacemaker potentials, right? And they're all connected by gap junction, so other pacemakers can develop inside the heart if the sinoatrial node is damaged. And we would call those what kind of pacemakers? Ectopic pacemakers. And an ectopic pacemaker is just a pacemaker in some location of the heart other than its normal location, right? So like an ectopic pregnancy is a pregnancy in somebody's body that is in an abnormal location. Could be fallopian tube, could be mesenteries within the small intestine or large intestine, okay, some other than normal place. And the heart ectopic pacemakers are not necessarily pathologic. They'll keep your heart functioning, all right, but of course, ectopic pregnancy is what? Always lethal. Ectopic pregnancy, ectopic pacemaker? Yeah, let's go back. So here is the normal pacemaker of the heart, the SA node. But let's just say somebody had a heart attack and it wiped out this region right here. It died. All of these other cells will spontaneously polarize, but at a slower rate compared to the SA node. And whichever cells depolarize at the fastest rate, maybe right in this region right here, right, this will become the pacemaker of the heart. But it's at what? A different location than the SA node, so we would call that an ectopic pacemaker. Okay. And if there is, somebody has a heart attack and it kills the atrioventricular bundle right here, so now there's no electrical communication between the atri and ventricles, there's going to be a pacemaker region within the ventricle someplace that will then pace the ventricles. And the atria will contract at one rhythm and the ventricles will contract at another rhythm. And that usually doesn't produce too much in the way of clinical problems if that were to happen. But it will probably feel a little funny. Okay, depending on circumstances. Okay, so myocardial cells. All right, so now we're done talking about nodal cells. Now we're actually talking about the contractile cells inside the heart. These are the myocardial cells. Their action potentials are a little bit different. Myocardial cells have a resting membrane potential of about minus 90. Typically in neurons we saw about, what, minus 70. They depolarize to threshold by action potentials originating from the SA node. How do these action potentials get from the SA node to these myocardial cells? Via gap junctions, right? Okay. So here is, I didn't do this for that other graph and I should have, here's a plot of what? Voltage versus time. So we're looking at an action potential from a myocardial or contractile cell. And does this look like any kind of action potential you've seen so far?
No.
New. Okay, this is special. All right. When these are stimulated, okay, when they depolarize from minus 90, when they reach threshold, there's a rapid depolarization due to voltage-gated sodium channels, and sodium just in the heart, just like everywhere else, is high on the outside of the cell. It rushes in, right, which causes even more depolarization, which causes more sodium channels open, causes more depolarization. So here we have a nice excitatory signal, which is going to start excitation-contraction coupling. But there are other channels besides sodium and potassium in the contractile cells of the heart. There are slow calcium channels that open up as well. And calcium then slowly diffuses into the cell. And what does that do to the membrane potential when calcium enters the cell? It causes depolarization or maintains depolarization because calcium is a cation, right? So that's going to make sure that the inside of the cell doesn't become negative. So we call this a plateau region within these contractile cells that's due to calcium. And then finally, the potassium channels kind of win out. They open up. And potassium will leave the cell that causes repolarization. All right, so this is a different kind of action potential that you find in the contractile cells of the heart. And this is real important because Unlike skeletal muscle, all right, heart muscle cannot go into tetany. All right, so why is it that it can't go into tetany? Because these calcium channels right here force these cells into an absolute refractory period. All right, so these sodium channels don't get reset until it goes back down to resting membrane potential. So these sodium channels are inactivated because of that inactivation gate, because calcium prevents repolarization. So this is a nice plateau phase right here. So the heart can't go into tetany. And what is tetanus in a skeletal muscle? When the muscle just stays contracted, okay? And the muscle cells, you know, there might be some relaxation in those muscle cells, but the reason why you can contract a biceps, like I'm contracting my biceps right now, and it stays contracted, it's not because all the muscle fibers are contracting. Some are contracting and then going into relaxation, and other muscle fibers start to contract, but there's always a large percentage that are contracting, so my biceps looks like it's contracting. But in the heart, how does the heart always contract? Every single fiber contracts at one time and then relaxes, right? So different fibers don't cycle through relaxation and contraction. And this phase, this plateau phase, right, prevents the stimulation of the myocardial cells into contracting once again, because this is an absolute refractory period right here.
It can go into summation though, right?
If there is, it's one way to potentiate the contractile force of heart tissue, and if, for instance, if calcium starts to build up inside the myocardial cell, then the force of contraction of that cell will increase, because that will enhance cross-bridge cycling. Okay, so summation can take place. I'm really tired of keeping that cursor active. So I'm going to see if I have my USB connector handy. Okay, so in the meantime, let's look at the next slide. All right, well, we looked at that slide already. We looked at that one. I'm going backwards, thank you. No wonder. Ah. I think we're doing okay. I talked about it already, so I jumped ahead a little bit, so we're going to skip this slide. I'm going to plug in my little adapter right here. Okay, so these Purkinje fibers spread depolarization because they're highly branched to a number of myocytes, right? So the apical regions contract first. Okay, next slide. All right, so action potentials within the atria spread out at a rate of about 1 meter per second. There's a time delay as it passes through the atrioventricular node, all right? And these fibers in the AV node have a slow speed of transmission of an action potential, right? Like 0.03 meters to second. And then when it gets down through the bundle branches and Purkinje fibers, right, then it's 10 times greater, 5 meters per second. So that just says that the apical regions of the heart receive depolarization before the basal regions do. All right, and because of the delay, the atria contract before the ventricle. So both atria followed by both ventricles. All right, now let's just see if I have my... Oh, switch. Now I bet I do. Yay. Okay. Now the cursor shouldn't disappear. All right, so what about excitation-contraction coupling in the myocardium? Okay, we talked about that. Depolarization of myocardial cell opens these voltage-gated channels, and then there's no ryanodine receptor, so when calcium starts to flood the inside of a myocardial cell, that opens calcium-induced calcium release channels, and then calcium binds to troponin, just like in skeletal muscle, and that stimulates the cycling of cross bridges. All right, during repolarization, calcium is pumped out of the cell and back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so then calcium unbinds from troponin and then tropomyosin, then covers up the binding sites, and the cardiac muscle can't contract when that happens. All right, so here is a plot of the absolute refractory period up against what we saw is an action potential. Now, what kind of action potential is this right here? What is generating this action potential?
Heart.
What kind of cell? Yeah, it's a heart. That's a good step.
Myocardial.
But remember, there are two kinds of cells.
Myocardial.
Myocardial cells are the contractile cells, right? Not the nodal cells, not the pacemaker cells, but the contractile cells exhibit this plateau phase due to what, calcium channels. And during this period of time, this is an absolute refractory period. So if the heart receives stimulation, right, it's not going to produce another action potential, and excitation-contraction coupling can't take place. So the heart can't go into tetany, which is a good thing. All right, so the action potential lasts almost for the full period of time when the heart is contracted. We can measure the electrical activity of the heart by putting surface electrodes on somebody. We call that electrocardiogram. These terms are synonymous. Right, because in Europe sometimes they spell cardiac with a K right here instead of a C. And even within a hospital, you might be following signs to ECG, to get an ECG, and in one hallway it's going to say ECG, and another hallway it's going to say EKG. So these are exactly synonymous terms. All right, and on the slide, we see that there are a number of waves that make up an electrocardiogram. And this electrocardiogram, and you see millivolt potential right over here. These are very easy to measure on the surface of somebody because there are as many as a trillion cells that make up the myocardium, and they all exhibit this kind of electrical activity. This electrical activity is conducted by the extracellular fluid, which is a salty solution to the surface of the body. So with surface electrodes, right, because of all those trillions of cells depolarizing and repolarizing, we can measure electrical activity with inside the heart. Okay, and so here is the electrocardiogram. The first wave right here is called the P wave. Anybody have an idea why this is called the P wave?
Primary.
Primary, that's a good way of thinking about it. I think of it as like the primavera. What's that mean? That means the first wave. Okay, that's the first wave. So here's the first wave. And this is the depolarization. This signifies depolarization of the atria, and that's a signal for contraction. So this is not a measure of tension versus time. This is a measure of what? Just electrical activity versus time. And electrical activity versus time is different than tension produced by a particular cell. So the electrical activity precedes contraction. So if there's no electrical activity in the heart, can the heart contract? No, it might want to, right? But if there's no electrical activity, then excitation contraction coupling can't even begin. All right, then we have another wave called the QRS, and this represents a depolarization of the ventricles. And it's a bigger wave. Why is that a bigger wave? Yeah, the chambers are huge compared to the atria, right? Many, many more times cells, so that voltage is a lot bigger. And also within this wave, there is another electrical signal, which you can't see because it's so small, and that is atrial repolarization. Okay, but it's embedded in this signal right here. Since we can't see it, it's really not useful clinically. All right, and then the QRS complex is followed by the T wave, and the T wave represents repolarization of ventricular tissue, right? So both the atria and ventricles undergo depolarization and repolarization. It's just that we can't see repolarization of the atria because that signal is so small. A good way to think about that is if you were to walk outside right now, well, it might be cloudy, but let's pretend there's no clouds outside. Okay, you walk outside, nice bright sunlight, and you look up in the sky, can you see any stars? Do you know that, are they there or are they not there? They are there, but you just can't see them. And why is that? Because the sun is just too bright, right? So it's a signal to noise issue. The same thing right here. We can't see repolarization of the atria because the QRS, the depolarization signal from the ventricles is just way too big to see it. Okay. And what we see on the second graph, superimposed with the same time axis over here, is an action potential of the contractile cells in the heart. And you can see that here is the absolute refractory period, okay, which then corresponds with contraction of the ventricles. And then after the ventricles relax, then the heart can be stimulated into contracting once again. But the heart has to relax, therefore it can't go into tetany. Okay, so know these different parts of the ECG. So I didn't go over the ECG when we looked at that Wiggers diagram, all right, but now go back and look at the Wiggers diagram. Oh, I wanted to pull that up before class. You will see, let's go back. You will see that the QRS complex, when it's plotted on the same time axis, do you think that happens before, at the same time, or after, right, we see a blip that would be the pressure produced by the ventricles. Remember on that Wiggers diagram, we actually had a pressure diagram, pressure inside the ventricles going from zero. What did the pressure inside a ventricle go from? From zero to what pressure? Nope, not 60. What's the maximum pressure inside of a ventricle in a normal textbook heart? 120, right? We call that systolic pressure, right? 120 millimeters of mercury. So you should notice that it comes after the QRS complex from 0 to 120. Okay. All right, so remember, ECG waveforms are not a measure of contraction. They are strictly what kind of events? Electrical events. So what do you call a machine that acquires and records an ECG? Electrocardiograph. Electrocardiograph. Yeah. What do you call the little piece of paper with an ECG on it? That's the electrocardiogram. Okay. So the graph makes the gram. Which events occur first in the heart? Mechanical contraction or electrical events? Yeah. Electrical events happen first. So here is just a slide that kind of shows in a video format. All right. The SI node. So. What does this look like right over here? Well, that's depolarization. What is that, yellow? Yeah. Okay, yellow. So yellow represents depolarization. SA node depolarizes first, and that wave of depolarization travels through both atria. It gets to the AV node right here, but there's a delay at the AV node, so depolarization does not enter the ventricles until after both atria depolarize completely. Right, and you can see what that looks like on the electrocardiogram right here. And then after the delay, the action potentials move very rapidly down through the bundle branches, right? And it stimulates it depolarizes the apical regions of the ventricles to contract. That produces a QRS complex right here. So the apical regions contract first, forcing blood up into the arteries, and then that's followed by repolarization of the apical regions first and then the basilar regions of the heart later, producing that T wave. Okay, so that's ECG. And I think you guys messed around with the ECG a little bit in lab. Oh, I got another slide. How many more slides are there? 100 more slides. Okay, well here is just a little modified Wiggers diagram, and this is pressure inside a ventricle, right? Starting at 0 going up to 120, and you can see that the ECG precedes contraction. That's what I just wanted to show you. All right, and then as the pressure rises inside the ventricle, it's going to actually right about at this point in time, as pressure starts to increase in the ventricle, it becomes greater than pressure inside the atria, so blood is going to try to flow backwards into the atria. But in a normal heart, what prevents that? Yeah, bicuspid valve or tricuspid valve, those are the atrioventricular valves. So during the beginning of systole, the atrioventricular valves slam closed and it produces this first heart sound. Yeah, so that's the AV valve closing. All right, then the heart contracts, goes through peak systole right here, then the pressure starts to drop because there's, even though the ventricle is contracted, the pressure drops because there's not any blood left in the ventricles to maintain that pressure, and it drops below the pressure of the aorta, So now blood from the aorta is going to want to flow backwards into a ventricle, but can it?
No.
No, because, again, there are valves. What kind of valves are at the root of the great arteries? The semilunar valves, they slam closed, that produces the second heart sound over here. All right, so that's pretty easy to understand. Structure of blood vessels. All right, so here are just some definitions from anatomy. And I don't think I want to go over all of these things because you should know this already. But as I look through these slides right here, what kind of blood vessel takes blood away from the heart? Okay, it's got to be an artery. It takes blood away from the heart. And is an artery always carrying the oxygenated blood?
No.
It can carry oxygenated or deoxygenated depending on what kind of circulation it's supplying, right? If it's pulmonary circulation, then the pulmonary artery is deoxygenated. If it's systemic, then it's oxygenated. Now, this slide I want to go over just a little bit. Types of capillaries. You learned about these in anatomy, but let's just review. Capillaries are important, okay, because they are thin. Maybe you need to go back and look at a slide. But a capillary only has an endothelial layer. Doesn't have elastic tissue, doesn't have smooth muscle tissue, and it has a very, very thin connective tissue basement membrane for the endothelium, and that's it. So diffusion can take place through a capillary because it is thin, okay? And diffusion cannot take place through arteries or veins because their walls are way too thick to allow for diffusion. Plus, they're not permeable to most substances anyway because of the connective tissue. So here are three kinds of capillaries, continuous capillaries. You have endothelial cells. They're joined together pretty tightly, right? They only have very narrow intercellular channels that permit exchange of molecules, right? And these have to be small molecules. So proteins, can you remember any proteins that are in the blood? Like, for instance, albumins, these molecules are way too big to leak out through these intercellular channels. All right, so things have to diffuse mostly through the cells themselves. Things that can diffuse through very nicely would be lipid-soluble substances, and water can leak out, and oxygen and carbon dioxide can pass through these capillaries without any problem. We find these in muscles, in lung, and adipose tissue. All right, the next kind are fenestrated capillaries. They have wide intercellular pores, so larger molecules can move out of the capillary, and a lot of water can move out as well. We find this in kidneys and in endocrine glands, right, because these are specialized for secreting hormones that get picked up by the blood, and also intestines because their job is for absorption. So you'd expect these capillaries to be a little bit more leaky. All right, then we got discontinuous. These have large gaps in the endothelium. And a good example of that would be in the liver. So these are the ones that are really, really leaky, allow for most exchange. And I think in anatomy we call these things sinusoids. Right? So the endothelial layer has big gaps and are really, really leaky. So a lot of fluid leaves a capillary into the interstitial spaces in these kinds of tissues right here. But none of these capillaries have spaces or gaps large enough for red blood cells to leave, right? Only molecules of different sizes. Water can go through pretty easily. Okay, veins. Veins contain the majority of blood in the circulatory system. They expand very easily, so small changes in pressure, all right, will produce a large expansion. So think of a balloon. Okay, when you blow air into the balloon, what happens to the pressure inside that balloon? It goes up and the balloon starts to expand. Okay, now maybe think of an inner tube that you have on your bicycle. And it's got a really thick rubber coat to it. So if you can you blow up your bicycle tire just by blowing into it? Because it takes way too much pressure to get it to expand. All right, so a vein is more like a balloon. Small changes in pressure allow it to expand, all right, as opposed to like an inner tube that you have on your bicycle. All right, so we call them compliant. All right, they have a lot of compliance because they expand readily. So small changes mean that veins can store a lot of blood. All right, they contain very low pressure, about 2 millimeters of mercury, and that's insufficient to return blood to the heart. So what do you need to get blood to move from one place to another? You need a pressure gradient. And how is blood going to flow? From high pressure to low pressure. And as soon as that gradient goes away, just like for diffusion, what happens to motion? What happens to flow? It stops, right? So diffusion, remember, diffusion stops when the concentration gradient goes away. Blood is going to stop flowing when this pressure gradient goes away. The pressure inside the right atrium is about at zero. Maybe it's a little bit below atmospheric pressure. So the total gradient is only about 2 millimeters of mercury. So you're probably wondering, well, how then does blood get back to your heart if there's so low pressure in a vein? And there are two important mechanisms, okay, as long as you don't stand on your head. If you stand on your head, then blood likes to flow to your heart just fine, right? But I don't see anybody standing on your head. Okay. There are special structures within veins. These structures, yeah, you find in your heart, and they prevent retrograde flow of blood. So blood only flows in one direction. And the lymphatic system also has these things, and they are valves. So here is a vein, highly compliant. It can change volume very easily with small changes in pressure. And so these flaps kind of remind me of a semilunar valve. They're made of the endothelium that makes the lining of this blood vessel right here. And this vein right here is in between two skeletal muscles. And when these skeletal muscles contract, what happens to them? What's happening? The answer is, oh, it bulges. Okay, so they bulge, muscles bulge, they get real thick. So here I see these muscles bulging right here. They pressurize this segment of a vein, produces high pressure just transiently when these muscles contract. And so then blood is going to want to go down to this low pressure region or this low pressure region, but can it get down to this region over here, back down to an extremity? Well, it can't, because as long as this is a nice healthy valve, blood can't flow retrograde, it can only flow to the heart. Okay. So that's one reason. We call this the skeletal muscle pump that moves blood back to your heart. And if you're not exercising your muscles, let's just say this is you on a flight from here to Denpasar. Where's Denpasar? It's about 18-hour flight. All right, that's in Indonesia someplace, right? So if you sit in your seat that whole time, here is blood in your veins, it's not moving. What does blood like to do when it's not moving? It likes to clot. And every once in a while, somebody forms a clot in a vein on a long flight. It could even be from Washington, D.C. to L.A., all right? And they get a pulmonary embolism, all right? So it's always a good idea to do what?
Move.
Yeah, move around. Get these muscles working, prevent stasis of blood in these veins right here. Complete your circulatory system, and that can prevent these embolisms from happening. It happened to some soldiers that were stuck in their Humvee vehicles in this last action. Oh, it happened to a news broadcaster, too, because the fighting in the Middle East was so bad, he didn't want to get out of his armored vehicle and just sat in there for days on end and got a pulmonary embolism as a result of that. All right, you'll have to tell me a story that you might be thinking of that's bringing a smile to your face. Am I making that up? Tell me after class if I am. Okay. Okay. So that's the importance of the skeletal muscle pump. Did you have a question?
Yeah, so this just basically observes it, though. Like, because the skeletal muscles are somatic and we have to move, they're voluntary.
They're voluntary, unless you hook up a TENS unit or something to stimulate them.
We absolutely have to move. We can't stay in one place, otherwise we get the coagulant or
whatever. It's a possibility.
Well,
it's not zero. Doesn't happen to everybody. It's relatively rare, but it certainly does happen. Oh, yeah, there's problems with patients. You can't just leave a patient lying in bed. You have to move them around, okay? Even if they can't move on there by themselves, physical therapy has to probably get in there and massage their different parts of their body that are immobile, or bad things will happen.
What about what about, like, then for, like, paraplegic and quadriplegic? Do they also need to, like, move their legs around even though, like, you know, they're...
Oh, yeah, probably so. Probably so. Yeah, these are huge problems. Yeah. So this is one pump that helps return blood to the heart. The second pump is what we call the respiratory pump. And we're going to get to your respiratory chapter before the end of the class. Okay. You move air in and out of your lungs by changing the volume of your thoracic cavity. Volume and pressure are inversely related to each other. All right, they're not directly related. So as the volume of your thoracic cavity increases, what happens to the pressure if it's inversely related? It goes down. Okay, so when you expand your thoracic cavity, pressure decreases in your thoracic cavity. So now it's low compared to the air. And remember, how does a fluid flow, including a gas? From high pressure to low. So if it's high pressure in the air, low pressure in your lungs, which way is air going to flow? It's going to flow in. Okay? So not only when you expand your thoracic cavity, not only does air flow into your lungs, but what else will flow into your thoracic cavity? Blood. That's right, because it's going to go from high pressure to low. So every time you inspire, by decreasing the pressure inside your thorax, you actually suck blood, acts like a vacuum cleaner that's bringing blood back to your heart. And then when you exhale, increase the pressure inside your thoracic cavity, how come blood doesn't go back down to your extremities? Because you have valves that prevent that from happening. And some people are missing these valves, right? They have vascular disease. These leaflets just kind of flop back and forth. They don't catch each other or touch each other again. And then that can produce thrombi in these different veins as well. Okay, that's another interesting, important clinical problem. All right, so that's it for this chapter. Yay. All right, so let's get through half of the next one. All right, we still have an hour in class. Okay, as long as I can find the little thing to click on. Let's do... Wait, you guys showed me something. You showed me how to close this. How do you close it? Is it on this one? Oh, no, this thing, that cursor doesn't work. Dang, okay, no, I need two cursors. I might have been on it. I just was using the wrong cursor. Close. Okay. Okay, so here's chapter 14. Okay, cardiac output. I think you guys cover this in lab already. Okay. Let me get some of these pointer options, arrow options. Visible. All right. Cardiac output. All right, so you got to write this down. Ooh, it looks like there was a wild biology class in here last time. Let's erase that cell. Let's analyze this cardiac output. All right, so what are the dimensions of cardiac output? What are the units? What are we trying to measure when we think of cardiac output? It's the amount of blood that the heart pumps every minute, okay? And it's a volume. What kind of measurement of volume are you aware of? We got gallons. We don't use that in science. So that was my attempt. What's your better attempt? Milliliters is really good, right? So cardiac output is measured in mLs per minute. All right? Milliliters per minute. And this is also... Oh, this was good just a couple seconds ago. Is this the marker I was using? All right, this is also what we call flow. Oh, come on, marker. Flow, blood flow. Blood flow is going to be measured in milliliters per minute. Okay, so when the heart pumps, it's causing blood to flow, and we measure that in milliliters per minute. So how can we measure that thing? We got something about here in time. All right, so what do we have in the heart that... you can measure in terms of time? How about something, something with your radial artery. You can measure beats per minute, right? So what do we call beats per minute? That's going to be heart rate. So I'm going to just abbreviate. Heart rate is in what? Beats per minute. That's the dimension of HR, okay? And if we multiply how many times your heart beats by how much volume is pumped out of the heart every time it beats, okay, we call that the stroke volume. So every time the heart contracts once, it ejects blood into an artery, we call that the stroke volume, and we're going to abbreviate that SR. And what are the dimensions of SR? It's going to be milliliters, all right, mLs per beat, every time the heart beats. All right, so I think it's kind of important to get these dimensions down, because then I think you can see it's much more intuitive to know something about cardiac output. And then what happens to these beats right here? Stroke volume. Oh, because I was talking and at the same time. SV, stroke volume, thanks. Okay, stroke volume. So these beats go away, and so what are we left with? Yeah, milliliters per minute. So that makes perfect time. And what is millimeters per minute in a physical sense? It's what? It's flow. It's blood flow. Okay, blood flow. And for the heart, we call that cardiac output. All right, so cardiac output, volume of blood pumped every minute by a ventricle. Oh, and what did we say about the cardiac output of the right ventricle and left ventricle? Okay. Should they be the same or can they be different? Okay. I'm glad I asked. Because they should be the same. But what's different, they can be different for a short period of time, but they should be the same. But what is different is the pressure that's produced. But we're not talking about pressure just yet. We're just talking about the amount of blood every time the heart contracts. All right, so the right ventricle is low pressure. The left ventricle is high pressure because the systemic circulation has a lot more resistance to it. So if the same amount of blood has to flow through the pulmonary and systemic circulations and one has high resistance, then it's going to take more pressure to get blood flow through the high resistance circuit, which is the systemic circuit. The same flow. Yeah, same volume per time. The right ventricle and left ventricle have to pump out the same volume per time. Now the length of these circulations are different, so the resistance is different between these two circuits. So in order to have the same flow, I'll have to show you some more equations, which we will in this chapter. In order to have the same flow, then the pressure has to be greater in the systemic circulation compared to pulmonary circulation. So since the pressure is different, the flow between the two circulations is the same. Okay. Okay, when we talk about heart rate, right, which is this term in cardiac output, right, which refers to the timing of the heart, right, the rhythmicity of the heart, then we call that chronotropy. So chronotropy has to do with heart rate. What's a chronograph? Chronograph is like a little wristwatch. It has to do, and what does it measure? It measures time, right? So timing has to do, anytime you hear chrono, think of time, right? So without neural influences, the SA node will drive the heart at a rate of its spontaneous depolarization due to those HCN channels, right? But we do know that the autonomic nervous system does go to the heart, and what it does, it influences, right, the sinoatrial node. And so it has a chronotropic effect. Sympathetic has a positive chronotropic effect on the heart, and the parasympathetic nervous system has a negative chronotropic effect on the heart. So when I say negative chronotropic effect, what does that mean? It slows the heart rate down. Sympathetic is a positive chronotropic influence on the heart because it speeds the heart up. And what can you tell me about the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system? They're what to each other? Antagonistic. But because these things mix together, your body has precise control and balance over heart rate. All right, so autonomic innervation of the SA node is the main controller of the chronotropy of the heart, or the heart rate. All right, so it just modifies the rate of spontaneous depolarization. How does that do that? It does it through these HCN channels. Right, norepinephrine and epinephrine stimulate opening of these pacemaker HCN channels. All right, so what really is happening when HCN channels open? That allows sodium to enter the cell, which causes faster depolarization. All right, so this depolarizes the SA node faster. And when the SA node depolarizes at a faster rate, that increases the heart rate of the heart. All right, as opposed to acetylcholine that promotes opening of potassium channels that counteracts, right, the HCN channels, right, so it slows the depolarization of the SA node, decreasing the heart rate. So here we see some, what the heck are these things? These are, I'll give you a hint, it's a plot of membrane voltage versus time. If you draw something with membrane voltage versus time, okay, what can you get? Well, you can get membrane potential, but if that membrane potential is in motion, we call it what? an action potential, right? When a membrane potential is an action, right, then that's an action potential. So here we see an action potential. We see three circumstances. One, during baseline conditions, right? The slope of this pacemaker potential right here is not steep, it's not shallow, right? And in this period of time, because of this slope of the pacemaker potential, it will produce two action potentials during this period of time. It can reach threshold twice. All right, but under sympathetic stimulation, more of these HCN channels will be opening up, which means what? A faster rate of depolarization, so it's going to reach threshold sooner. So in that same period of time, instead of two action potentials, it's going to produce three action potentials. What happens to heart rate? The heart rate increases, right? Because these then are going to spread through the whole heart because of gap junctions. All right, but under parasympathetic stimulation, these potassium channels open up, which slows the rate of depolarization. So the pacemaker potential right here has a very shallow slope, so it takes longer to get to threshold. And in the same period of time, how many action potentials will that produce? Only one, thus slowing the heart rate. Okay, so the autonomic nervous system works through these HCN channels or potassium channels to adjust the rate of spontaneous depolarization, which then adjusts the heart rate. And in terms of cardiac output, what term in cardiac output is being adjusted right here? Cardiac output on the board. Is stroke volume being adjusted or heart rate?
Heart rate.
Heart rate. And I want you to think of these things, these two things, as being independent of each other. Heart rate is independent of stroke volume. So heart rate is just beats per minute. Stroke volume, another way to think about stroke volume is contractility of the heart. Contractility, which is force of contraction. As the heart gets stronger, what happens to the stroke volume? As the heart contracts with more force, what happens to stroke volume? It's directly related. It goes up. As the heart gets weaker, the contractility goes down. What happens to stroke volume? Then it goes down. More blood is left in the ventricles when it contracts, when it gets weaker. All right, so the stroke volume goes down. But what we've talked about so far is chronotropy, which has to do with what? The heart rate. All right, so there's one more term with this cardiac output equation right here. Okay, and that is force of contraction. And the term that's used to describe the force of contraction is not chronotropy, because that refers to rate, is what? Inotropy. Force of contraction of the ventricles. All right, so let's talk about regulation of inotropy, or the contractility or force of contraction of the heart. The cardiac control center, and usually I call it the cardioregulatory center, in the medulla, activates autonomic innervation, right? In particular, sympathetic outflow from the cardioregulatory center. These sympathetic nerves go to the atria and the ventricles, and they can stimulate increase in strength of contraction or force of contraction. So the sympathetic nervous system can influence the chronotropy on the heart, but also the inotropy. Right, so positive increases, negative decreases. What's going to happen to cardiac output if the heart rate increases? What is the relationship between cardiac output and heart rate? You can see it is what? Directly related. So when heart rate increases, what happens to cardiac output? It increases as well. What about stroke volume? If something is a positive inotropic agent, it increases stroke volume. What happens to cardiac output? Since it's directly related, it increases as well. All right, and what happens if you increase both heart rate and stroke volume at the same time? What happens to cardiac output? It goes way up, right? So it's the multiplication of those two terms right there. Which way do I go? Right over here. Okay, so here's a really interesting table. On this table right here, we see regions affected in the heart. So we got SA node, AV node, atrial muscle and ventricular muscle, and we're going to see what the effects are of the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system. Here's sympathetic in the second column, parasympathetic in the third column. All right, so if we increase sympathetic outflow to the SA node, right? That increases the rate of diastolic depolarization, right? It's going to make the slope of that pacemaker potential really steep. That increases heart rate, right? But the so that's just at the SA node. There are parasympathetic nerves that go to the SA node as well, right? And these are going to open potassium channels when acetylcholine is applied to them. That decreases the heart rate, right? So that decreases the rate of those pacemaker potentials during diastolic depolarization. So that decreases the heart rate. So these are what kind of cells? Contractile cells or nodal cells? These are just the nodal cells, right? So, and then we have some more nodal cells in the AV node. Sympathetic stimulation increases the rate of conduction through the AV node, but parasympathetic decreases the conduction rate. So that, again, is going to slow the heart rate down. All right, so now here we get to something interesting. Let's talk about the muscles themselves of the atria. Sympathetic nerves go to the atria, and they release norepinephrine. That causes an increase in contraction or increased contractility of the atrial muscle cells. So in cardiac output equation right here, what term is being affected right now? It's the stroke volume. So the stroke volume of the atria increases when that happens. But over here, look at parasympathetic effects. No significant effect, and that's because parasympathetic nerves do not go to atrial muscle. They only go to the SA node and AV node. So they can't have an effect on atrial muscle. So it can't change anything about the inotropy of the atrium. And the same thing, and this is really strange, parasympathetic nerves don't go to ventricular muscle. Sympathetic nerves do. Sympathetic nerves are positive inotropic, have a positive inotropic effect on the heart, but since sympathetic nerves or parasympathetic nerves don't go to the ventricular muscle, they can't have any effect. Right? So they're just neutral in terms of their inotropy on the heart. They have no significant effect. All right, so sympathetic nerves have four important effects on the heart, but parasympathetic, right, only have two. And in particular, parasympathetic nerves can only affect the heart rate, but not force of contraction. So that's something interesting. That's an important point in the quiz for today. In lab, okay? So I didn't have a chance to really talk about it, but it's time to end. So we're going to start talking about stroke volume next time. But if you memorize that equation for the quiz in lab this week, it will help you a lot to understand the discussion that we're going to go over. Okay, so there might have been a sign-in sheet. Anybody pass a sign-in sheet around?
Yeah.
Oh, it's right down over here, so before you leave, go ahead and sign in to the sign-in sheet.